Today's episode is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/atheistnomads. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. That's audibletrial.com/atheistnomads. We are the Atheist Nomads, bringing you history, science, politics, religion, and interviews with leaders in the atheist community. Not all those who wander are lost. Welcome to another episode of Atheist Nomads. This is episode number 41. Later in the episode, we'll be joined by none other than Sean Faircloth to talk about the Secularity USA project, which he envisions as changing America and providing, for a change, an actual counter to the religious right. So definitely stick around for the interview. I am Dustin, and joining me as always is Wesley.
Hey, how's it going, man?
It's going pretty good. How about you?
I'm feeling pretty fucking good.
Nice.
House is a little chilly, but yeah, everything is pretty decent. I've actually been reading a couple of comics lately.
Cool. Yeah, you brought up temperature. It's finally above freezing here.
Ditto. Yeah. We actually were hitting single digits for a couple nights last week.
Oh, we were down in the negatives those nights.
Yeah, but you live in a fucked up area. Come on.
Yeah, I saw an article yesterday about the U.S. House of Representatives actually passing some legislation. One is a really big budget deal that will prevent default and shutdowns and cut down on some of the spending cuts.
Yeah, I got an email passed around to me from work, at work, and what they were saying is that basically this is going to negatively influence a lot of government employees. Like the ones that are coming in, getting hired now, are actually going to get paid less than the ones that were hired, you know, a month before.
Yeah.
And it's going to affect retirement and a few other things also.
Yeah. It's very much it's a compromise. The right got some of what they wanted and the left got some of the things they wanted.
Yeah. And the right got their opportunity to fuck more people over.
Yeah. But at least the government will stay open for this foreseeable future.
Yeah. You know what? I'm kind of the mind of saying, fuck it. You know what? You want to go sequester? Fine. I will either be on unemployment for a while or B, get paid later. So fine. If you guys want to give me a paid vacation, yeah, don't do anything. But just irks the fuck out of me.
Yeah. One thing that deal didn't include that Democrats were at least really wanting, and also the Office of Management and Budget it was Congressional Budget Office. It was the group was really pushing for getting included was an extension of the emergency unemployment benefits, which allows those out of work to roughly double the length of time that they're eligible for unemployment. And that length of time actually varies based on what state you're in. And if you're in a state like Idaho, they go for about as short as they possibly can on everything.
Obviously.
Yeah. Fun times. Anyway, let's go ahead and move on to feedback. We got a voicemail from Russ.
Hey, boys, it's Russell. I'm out here on my deck freezing my nards off in Kitsap County, but I just went nuclear on your ass. Does anybody have the balls to follow me? Have a good one. Love the show. Bye.
This is definitely the time that I love it when somebody goes nuclear on my ass.
Yes. Definitely want to encourage anybody who wants to go nuclear on us.
So, does anybody else have the cojones, the balls, the marbles, the things,
the ovaries?
Yeah,
it won't include ovaries or the ultimate human super organ, the vagina, on that list.
The vajayjay. All right. Does anybody have those have the moral fortitude to pick up Russell's challenge? I'm gonna call this the Russell Challenge.
I like it. Renee Davis Pelt actually did, and she beat Russ by a couple days.
Oh shit!
Two people have gone nuclear on us.
Oh shit! Thank you, Russ. Really appreciate it. And Renee, you both are diehard supporters. We really appreciate it.
Yes. Yeah. One word to the wise, the way those subscriptions are set up is if you already have one in existence, you need to go into your PayPal settings and cancel it before you start a new one.
Unless you would like to donate twice. I'm just saying. Yes.
If you're just wanting to upgrade, yes, cancel the old one. If you're just wanting to give us lots and lots of money, then go ahead and create as many as you want.
Which, you know, won't turn that down.
No. I will send you a friendly email letting you know that you have multiple plans open, but I won't stop you from doing it.
Yeah, but anyways, yes, Russell's challenge. The gauntlet has been thrown, so.
Yeah. And he even threw that down asking who's got the balls for it while his were freezing. That's diehard right there. That's awesome.
Hopefully they weren't, you know, frozen to the deck, which would necessitate, you know, a bottle of warm water and a spatula.
I was thinking a bottle of whiskey.
Well, only if he wants to stay out there.
Stay out there and numb the pain a little.
All right, numb the pain, then the warm water, then the spatula.
Chug the whiskey, pour warm water, spatula, chug more whiskey.
Oh no.
Finish the whiskey at that point, yes. Yeah. Well, actually, this is the holiday season, so it should be rum for mixing with your eggnog.
I don't understand the hatred towards eggnog. I actually like this stuff.
Well, I get some of it if you buy eggnog at the grocery store, the non-alcoholic stuff, and you try to drink it straight. It is so thick and syrupy.
I have like two glasses a year, and I really like it.
Hmm.
I get like the pint, the 2 pint or whatever it is, the tall skinny one,
mm-hmm.
and I'll drink that, and that's it. That's like maybe a glass and a half. And I like that.
When I was a kid, I'd cut it with milk, about 50-50. Now I cut it with rum. And
about 50-50.
Actually, about two parts eggnog to one part rum seems to be about perfect.
Hmm.
And, oh, it's so good.
Are you talking about like spiced rum or that coconut crap?
Spiced rum.
Okay.
Like Bacardi.
All right. I have a loathing for coconut rum. I mean, absolute gag reflex. It's like drinking coconut perfume.
But for a little history note on eggnog, it actually is the original American beverage. Back in the colonial days, rum was readily available in the colonies. It was part of the trade circle that, you know, brought up the rum from the Caribbean. And the way they'd make it back in the day was take a bucket of rum out to the barn and milk the cow directly into it. And I guess they started cracking eggs into it and adding some nutmeg and other spices, and eggnog was born.
Nice.
So, yeah, if you want to contact us with some feedback, you can email us at contact@atheistnomads.com, or you can call us and leave us a voicemail message at 541-203-0666. And you can also go to our website and sign up to donate money to us, either a one-time donation or a recurring monthly payment at various different levels, especially if you take up the Rust Challenge and go nuclear on us. You can also support us by following the link off the website to Amazon and finish up your last-minute holiday shopping. And we'll get a little cut off of that. You won't see any additional prices, but we'll see a small percentage of commission.
And I just want to point out again that that is completely anonymous. You know, everybody's security and you know, sex toys are safe. You know, we won't know who's buying what, so don't worry about that.
And I think it is time to play the Foundation Beyond Belief plug for the last time. Yeah. We'd made a promise to them to play it all year until they reached their 2,500 member goal, and I am very disappointed to say that despite our support, they're at 1,571.
Holy crap.
Yeah. Their goal to double their membership didn't work all that well.
Well, still a very worthwhile group. And Dale's quite a nice guy.
Awesome, awesome group. They've already given $1.4 million to various awesome charities.
And that's off of 1,600 members. Holy shit. Think of what they could do with 2,600 members.
Yeah, or 26,000.
Foundation Beyond Belief is a community of compassionate humanists and atheists supporting outstanding charities worldwide. Members sign up for automatic donations starting at $5 a month, then distribute those funds however they wish among the featured charities. To date, this unique humanist organization has raised over $750,000 to make this world a better, more humane place. We don't look to the skies for a better world. Foundation Beyond Belief is humanity at work. Learn more or join us at foundationbeyondbelief.org.
All right, you ready for history?
So this is all for December 19th. So this day in history, 1917, the National Hockey League, the NHL, opens its first season. Hooray for Yay. Sports ball. So in what was probably seen as like a preemptive strike, white people formed the NHL to have a sport all for themselves. That's really all I have for that one. Just because it's a sports ball thing.
They were actually looking at this article. It was Canadian.
Yeah, yeah. Montreal had two teams, the Canadiens and the Wanderers. Ottawa Senators, Quebec Bulldogs, Toronto Arenas. Because who wants to have a confusing name like Arena?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But, yeah, you know, we had the American Hockey League, the National Hockey Association, and the Pacific Coast League, PCLs, and they finally formed under the NHL banner. Looks like around World War II, when the NHA just pretty much stopped.
Mm-hmm.
So, it looks like, yeah, this, you know, the Stanley Cup thing has been going on for a while.
And named after Lord Stanley, the English Governor General of Canada in 1892.
Huh.
Starting the first hockey championship.
Well, we do.
Hmm.
All right. This day in history, 1941. Hitler takes command of the German army. I want to put this out there. This is purely from a strategic point of view. This is one of the stupidest things Hitler ever did as a leader of the Nazis. That was to remove the officers from the military that had shown any sign of weakness or doubt in the command. This included generals like Hans von Kluge, who was being beaten down by the harsh Russian winter and also getting shredded by the Russians when Germany didn't send enough supplies to keep their army sustained and warm. With the Germans being about 200 miles away from Moscow, getting beat down by the guerrilla tactics that the Russians were giving, and just that cold-ass Russian winter, that was actually a really debilitating thing for the Germans. So it was like their first big defeat in a way. And, yeah, had a horrible effect on the Germans for a while, and Hitler just wanted nothing to do with it and fucking just started saying, okay, you're fired, you go away, you go to the front as a fucking troop, just doesn't matter. He was just kind of throwing all of his talent away, and he decided to become the commander-in-chief of his army. That really didn't go very well. Go mm-hmm. figure. A non-military mind.
Yeah, you know, the U.S. president holds the title of commander-in-chief.
Yeah, but this guy meant it.
Yeah, there's a huge difference between signing off on a few actions and giving very broad orders and actually running a military. And if you look at historical, precedents, militaries run by civilians don't do well. Militaries run by military officers tend to do much better. Now, it often is very beneficial, especially if you're wanting to maintain a democratic society, to have civilian control over the military, but you want the military actually running itself.
Yeah, for the most part, yeah. I mean, you don't want the fuckers to run amok, but you need, especially in a war, you need to have people that actually know strategy to do said strategy.
Yeah.
Go figure.
Yeah, you know, this is, I guess, really belongs on the list of really stupid things the Axis powers did in 1941 that brought about their defeat, right along with declaring war on Russia and the U.S.
Yeah, the last thing you want to do is fucking fight on two fronts if you don't have to.
Yeah.
And Russia was fine with staying the fuck out of it.
Yes, they were.
Just like we were, supposedly, until the fucking Japanese, you know, bombed the shit out of us. So, yeah. Whole bunch of stupid fucking mistakes. Hooray for mistakes on their end.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, you don't want a sociopath like Hitler not making mistakes. You want a sociopath like Hitler making lots of them.
So, yeah. Hey, he did a great fucking job at that.
Yes, he did. Oh, shit.
All right, so this day in history, 1972, the last lunar landing mission ends. It's actually kind of sad. Apollo 17 splashed down in the Atlantic on this day, ending 3 years of manned missions to the moon. All told, there were 6 successful missions to the moon during that time. A couple of interesting side notes. During Apollo 17, Eugene Cernan and Harrison Schmitt stayed on the surface for a record amount of time, 75 hours, conducting separate excursions, like romping around in a lunar lander and collecting 243 pounds of rock and soil. This was not the last Apollo mission, however, which that was actually in 1975 when the U.S. and USSR docked together while in orbit of the Earth. But, yeah, no person has been back to the moon since then, which is too bad because there's a fuckload of innovation that goes on with, one, with war, and two, with science exploration like this. And, well, we're getting a fuckload of war, but I'd sure like to see some more exploration.
Yes. The amount of technologies that came out of the space race were just phenomenal.
Oh, yeah. I've always seen it that, seen stats something like, was it 6 times the amount of money that you put into it, you'll get out of it? It's some crazy stat.
Wow.
Where, you know, all the technologies that you get out of it will just help feed the market so much more than what you put into it. Anyways, all right. Okay, next up, Mars. Let's do this shit. And this day in history, 1998, President Clinton was impeached. So this is a tale of a stain on a dress and cigars. House of Representatives charged Clinton with 2 articles of impeachment on this day, lying under oath and obstruction of justice. So most people know that Bill Clinton had a year and a half long affair with the unpaid intern, Monica Lewinsky. She was transferred to the Pentagon after that. That's where she met Linda Tripp, who went whitewater on her ass and started recording the details of Monica Lewinsky's exploits. Woo. So, yeah, all told, I mean, basically, yeah, sure. Dude, he had an affair. I don't see why this was made such a big deal of between the American public and him, when it should have just been a big deal between him and, well, his wife. So on February 12th of 1999, the Senate voted on whether to remove Clinton from office. Turns out, of course, the president was acquitted on both articles of impeachment. The prosecution needed a 2/3 majority to convict, but failed to achieve even a bare majority. They rejected the first charge of perjury, with 45 Democrats and 10 Republicans voting not guilty. And on the charge of obstruction, the Senate was split 50-50. After the trial, the president said he was profoundly sorry for the burden his behavior imposed on the Congress and the American people.
It was a case where something that shouldn't have ever been a big deal turned into one. At the point that a private matter becomes investigated and brings about intentional actions to hide what was going on, and statements made under oath that could easily be viewed as perjury, it shouldn't have ever started.
Yeah, I mean, fucking, this is something that should have been dealt with between him and Hillary.
Mm-hmm.
Just like celebrities, you know, I don't see the need to just fucking throw all that shit out in the public sphere. I don't know. That's just me.
Yeah, because either A, it's going to cause a lot more pain for the betrayed party than they need to go through by making it public, or B, under the terms of their relationship, it's okay, and it's a non-issue. Either way, the public doesn't need to be drawn in.
Yeah, totally.
It does no good for anyone. Actually, as I recall, the person who really won out of this was Lewinsky, when she got either a book or movie deal out of it.
I don't remember ever seeing a movie, so I'm guessing books.
But I may not be remembering right.
I always thought that it was Linda Tripp, because I know that she's had a couple books, I think, out of this.
That could be. I know somebody made some money off of it.
Oh, yeah, there's always money to be made off of fucking scandal and shit.
Mm-hmm. But sex shouldn't be a political scandal.
Nope. This article actually points out that during a 4-minute televised address to the nation, Bill admitted that he had engaged in inappropriate relationship with Lewinsky. In that speech, though, which was wrought with legalisms, the word sex was never spoken, and the word regret was only used in reference to his admission that he had misled the public and his family, which is the way it should have been.
Mm-hmm.
Fuck that, you know. Yeah, there's no reason for us to be digging in this trash like that. Oh, boy. Anyways, on this day in history, 2005, Ahmadinejad bans all Western music in the Iranian state on their television and radio broadcasts. Yeah, so this one, not really big news, but, you know, chuckle-worthy to me.
Mm-hmm.
Muhammad Ahmadinejad gave the thumbs down to all Western musicians and many more when he announced a total ban on Western music on the state-run television and radio. Yeah, not really a big surprise. So the former mayor of Tehran is not really broaching anything that was really out of the ordinary, but, you know, still it was kind of chuckle worthy to me. This is not new ground, though. You know, the first known pronouncement by a public figure regarding, god damn it, this isn't really new ground, though. The first known pronouncement by a public figure regarding the potential of popular music to act as a socially destabilizing force comes from the first century BC, when none other than the great philosopher Plato wrote, "When the mode of music changes, the walls of the city shake." Go figure, ain't that the fucking truth?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, that's what I got for history this week.
Alrighty.
Alright.
For you, the listeners of Atheist Nomads, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. You might want to check out An Appetite for Wonder, The Making of a Scientist by Richard Dawkins, narrated by Richard Dawkins and Lala Ward. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/atheistnomads. Again, that's audibletrial.com/atheistnomads for your free audiobook.
I really like it when him and Lala do their audio narrations. They make a good combo.
All right, and now it's time for science and technology.
Hi.
Curiosity has been continuing to do awesome awesome stuff on Mars. And what they have found in the Gale Crater is that it was at one time watery, probably ringed by ice and snow. And based on the chemistry they're finding in the rocks, it's looking like it had the potential to support the same type of microbe that's found in caves on Earth. These are chemolithoautotrophs, type of bacteria that, they can feed off of rocks and make their own energy.
Wait, you're saying there's Martians, or could be, could have been.
They have not found any evidence to suggest organic matter at this point, but they have been finding evidence that the potential conditions for life have been present.
Hmm.
They're going to need to continue looking for more, but yeah, they have not yet found direct evidence of life at any time.
I'm going to work my way backwards on that and still say that is direct evidence of life on Mars.
Really?
That is my hypothesis. Everything else, I'm going to say that trails back and says there is life.
Hmm. I just go with a little more hedge statement that Mars at one time had conditions that would allow for it. It means life was possible, not that necessarily there was life.
I'm just trying to be like the religious and, you know, start with the conclusion and work backwards.
Oh, yes.
See what I did there?
Yes.
Yeah, all right. All right.
The International Space Station is, it's getting old.
Hmm.
As technology ages, it has a tendency to develop problems, especially when exposed to, well, space. And the latest one on the International Space Station is a pump on one of its two external cooling loops that is shut down. It hit a high temperature limit, and they found that it was producing too much ammonia. And it actually works through ammonia. But it was... Yeah, it was just getting too hot. It wasn't working properly. It wasn't cooling things adequately. So they've had to shut down a number of non-critical systems to avoid potential heating issues.
Shut up.
Or cooling issues, to be more precise.
There's actually six people up there right now.
Yes. So should be noted that this is not impacting any of the life support systems.
Okay, good, good.
Yeah, everything critical is still golden.
Holy shit. I just found probably the best fucking thing ever.
Yeah?
Yeah. Instant message coming in. There's a crow that is using a mayonnaise lid as a sled. It slides down the slope of this, like, house's roof, and then it flies the lid back up and slides back down again. How is that for tool using?
Right,
and just kind of
fucking
cool.
This is amazing.
Right? And there's a whole bunch of trails you can see on that roof. He's been doing it for a while.
Even trying to push himself further down?
Yeah.
Going back up. Wow. All right, that link is going in the show notes.
Yeah, right?
Under the crow we talked about. Awesome. All right, moving along. A team of scientists from the University of Washington have been looking at DNA and discovered that there's actually a second layer of code.
Hmm.
Yeah, they were, for a long time, the, 64 quote letter alphabet made up of these codons, have been, being decoded, and it's been found to be a very amazing way of storing a lot of information. But what they're finding is that some of these codons, which they're calling duons, can have two meanings. One of the meanings relates to the protein sequence and the other one to gene control. And so what they've thought, in the past is that these genes only, impact the production of proteins. But now they're finding this additional amount of information it can control these genes, turn stuff, I guess, on and off and stabilize them, stabilize certain features to go into these proteins. And so now they're going to be looking at, whether or not this can help with diagnosing and treating diseases and whether or not, you know, some diseases are disrupting this gene control. The leg bone of a 400,000-year-old hominid has been found to have some DNA left in it. Now, of course, the older you get with stuff, the less DNA will remain. But they found some DNA left and are trying to figure out, you know, what can they learn from that. So they're going to be doing sequencing on it, and yeah, we'll learn more about some of our ancestors.
That sounds pretty cool. They're thinking the fossil may carry traits of Neanderthals, and which may either belong to Homo heidelbergensis or other representatives of the Neanderthal lineage.
Heidelbergensis?
Yes.
Heidelbergensis.
You can't say people's last names, and I can't say scientific ones. All right, that's fair enough. We've discovered our weaknesses.
Yes, I've studied too many languages to know which rules to apply.
So awesome.
Yeah.
On to Archway.
Yes. It's time for a word from our sponsor. Do you have an idea for a website but don't know how to get started? Are you tired of expensive hosting draining your budget dry? Archway Hosting can help. Our fully functional hosting service starts at $20 per year. That includes hosting, databases, email, and much more. We also do web design and web development. Check us out at archwayhosting.com. That's ARCHWAY hosting.com. And now, politics and religion. We're going to start off with one that kind of fits along with, you know, kind of the border between medicine and human rights. There was a 12-year-old boy in Stratfordville, Ontario, in Canada, who suffered from asthma. And he died at school because he couldn't get to his inhaler in time because it was locked in the principal's office.
Are you shitting me?
No.
Okay.
No. He told his friends that he wasn't feeling well. They had to try to carry him to the office to where the inhaler was, and they couldn't reach it in time because it was locked. This kid with, you know, obviously very severe asthma repeatedly got his inhalers taken from him by staff because school policy is that students can't have medicines, including inhalers, on them. They must be locked up, usually in the principal's office. And so this has prompted a push to review the legislation and introduce some new legislation in Canada that would require comprehensive asthma programs so that students can have one inhaler on them and another one in a secure backup location. Principal's office, school nurse's office, something like that, but allow them to have one on them, assuming a doctor says that the student can have that. And things like inhalers and the EpiPen are designed for the end user to use them. They are highly critical and important to ensure you can survive, and it's something you have to be able to get quickly or it won't work.
Having to have people actually carry your body, physically carry your body down to the office because you can't actually get there.
Mm-hmm.
Something's fucking wrong.
Yeah.
There's a little lapse there. I'm just going to go out on a limb.
Yeah. Yeah. We both suffer from allergies.
Yep.
I've got a few EpiPens. Granted, my allergies aren't too terribly severe. The likelihood of needing an EpiPen would be slim.
Wow.
But if, you know, with the number of kids out there, especially that have very severe nut allergies, not being able to carry that with them, or a kid with asthma not being able to carry an inhaler, it's just needless. It's being overly paranoid and risking death.
Hmm.
It's insane and it's stupid and it needs to stop. Sonia Gandhi is often considered to be India's most powerful politician. She is the head of the Congress Party that has been in power since 2004. And she is pissed off in what the Indian Supreme Court just ruled. In 2009, the Delhi High Court decriminalized same-sex intercourse between consenting adults, but that only applied to the nation's capital. They had considered trying to bring apart some actual laws after that, but ended up deciding not to. And the Supreme Court just threw out that ruling and upheld the 153-year-old colonial law from back during British rule, when they created Section 377 of the Indian Penal Code in 1960, outlawing, and I quote, "carnal intercourse against the order of nature with any man, woman, or animal." Breaking that law can result in imprisonment or a fine, but prosecution on it is very rare. And now Gandhi is wanting the legislature to take this up and get rid of that stupid law. Actually, she's wanting to go a little further than that. She's wanting them to amend the Constitution. And in other news, also included in the same article, Australia's top court nullified the first same-sex marriages to occur in Australia.
I believe it's 27 same-sex marriages are about to get annulled.
Yep.
That is fucked up.
Yeah, the Australian Capital Territory began to allow a same-sex marriage this year. And, yeah, the Australian Supreme Court decided that is invalid and it's unconstitutional.
On a related note, a whole bunch of Christian fucks are cheering right now.
Mm-hmm. Cheering there. They're cheering for Russia. Yeah.
Oh, goodness.
And some good news. U.S. District Judge Larry Burns has ordered that the 43-foot cross on top of Mount Soledad in San Diego must be removed within 90 days. If they appeal this, then that could be postponed.
First, I want to say that's badass. But second, this is actually a like decades-long, 20-year-plus-long legal case. And the guy that actually originally brought the case died. And you know, another person picked up the torch and kept it going.
Yeah. They've been doing some weird little legal tricks to try to avoid this this ruling. Because, yeah, that first suit was brought by two Vietnam War veterans in 1989. And it was on the grounds that it violated the California Constitution. And the city of San Diego tried on two occasions to sell the property underneath the cross to the Mount Soledad Memorial Association, but the court stopped them each time. Then they reached an agreement in 2004 to move it to a new nearby church, but two congressmen intervened and got it designated as a national memorial and authorized the federal government to accept the donation of the property. And so now that's federal land, not city land. And it was actually seized by eminent domain when they took it in 2006. And so now the new lawsuit is all on federal court and on federal grounds. This is a long-standing fight.
I'm sure it's not the last we'll hear of it.
No. Fortunately, the courts were involved early enough to prevent this from being transferred into private hands. If you look at the cross on Table Rock in Boise, that one was put up in the 50s, same time period as this cross. And when the state government began to see courts ruling against stuff like that on private property, they went ahead and sold a couple of square feet of land under the cross to a private group. And so then when there was finally a lawsuit about it and about that land sale being illegal, which it clearly was, it was given to a private group with no state-mandated bidding process. It was thrown out by the judge claiming that it's on private property now and that private owner has had it for too long. at least in California, they didn't do that.
I think there was another little side bit on that, that Mount Soledad in California, that the Ninth Circuit Court basically pushed it back down to lower courts, and the lower court, that judge basically had his hands tied by the Ninth Circuit. So this might be really close to the last we'll hear about it.
Yeah.
Hey.
That would be nice.
Yeah.
This next one's coming from the Rock Beyond Belief blog, which is now being managed by Paul Lobe, who we were supposed to have on the show a while back, but he ended up not being able to do it, and Justin Griffith and Christopher Herr came on.
I was just talking with him last night out of the blue. Seemed like a pretty good guy.
Yeah. He has taken the position of Special Projects Manager with the Military Religious Freedom Foundation and received complaints from 30-some-odd airmen at Shaw Air Force Base about a nativity scene that had been put up next to Memorial Lake. Nowhere near any of the chapels, nowhere near any place where it would be justifiable to have it located. And he reached out to his boss and his position with the MRFF, Mikey Weinstein, who got on the phone with Air Force leadership, and within a couple of hours, it had been taken down.
Fucking A.
Yeah.
Oh, I would also like to give a quick plug for Paul has a podcast too. The Sergeant Skeptic podcast. He's on iTunes at least. I'm not sure about other places, but
very nice. Yeah, any podcast that's on any podcast that's on iTunes is getting on there through an RSS feed. And so if you've got an Android device, with most podcatchers, you can just grab that RSS and subscribe.
Cool.
But one thing that has been interesting with this is this story actually has gotten out into the media some and gotten a lot of Christians outraged that the Air Force would take down a nativity scene. And these atheists are just going after them, even though Weinstein's a Jew and the vast majority of their members in the MRFF are Christian. And the majority of the officers and enlisted men who contacted them to complain about this, actually it was 41 people who complained, are Christian.
Oh my goodness.
It was Christians complaining about the rules being broken.
Fucking A. Good on them.
Yeah.
You know, equality for all.
Exactly.
Well, good on them. Fucking A.
Yeah. Next, we've got
some awesome, funny ass news.
Yes. And the summary I got for it, the best one and most direct from them, is actually from their Indiegogo page. I'm not supporting or endorsing this or encouraging you to donate any money to it, but
I kind of am.
There's the link anyway. The Satanic Temple has begun to the process to donate a public monument to the Oklahoma Capitol Preservation Commission to sit next to the Ten Commandments monument that's already there. And this would be a monument to Satan.
That's right. The group that was founded by Anton LaVey, you know, all those little Emperor Ming looking Satanists out there that want to have their own little statue out there. So, hey, cool. Mm-hmm. Bring it on. I mean, this is completely in line with what Oklahoma has granted the public, all the religious groups out there. I mean, who wants to, I mean, they don't want to show, and they don't want to show like favoritism towards just the Christians, do they?
Oh, they probably do.
They do, of course. that is the Oklahoma City. That is the Oklahoma law, though. So, you know, this is open for all groups.
Yeah,
I know the Buddhists are trying to get in on this also.
Good for them. There's actually currently a lawsuit up against Oklahoma from the ACLU. On the grounds that the monument stands alone with no other monuments or memorials in the immediate vicinity, and that it is self-evidently exclusive in its religious message that, and I quote, supports and endorses the faiths and creeds of some churches and sects. So if the Satanists can get their monument up and Buddhists can get theirs up, it'll all be cool.
Yeah.
If the Christians want to keep their Ten Commandments, it's going to have to be next to Lucifer.
Side note, you might remember this is the same group of Satanists that just a few months ago post-death baptized Fred Phelps's mother into being a lesbian. You know, they had a gay couple in a ceremony, all dancing and kissing and whatnot, above, you know, Fred Phelps's mom, and turned her into a lesbian post-death.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because religion.
Yes. You know,
that's a thing, and obviously she is now a lesbian.
Yep. Yeah. Yep.
Oh, man. I love it.
By and large, I think the whole Satanist thing is...
They're atheists having fun,
yeah,
to me, for the most part.
For the most part, it seems silly and counterproductive, but there's times like this when it's just awesome.
I mean, from what I've read, most of them are basically just atheists,
mm-hmm,
but there a lot of them are using this as a way to push the buttons of the religious right and to set straight some church-state boundaries.
Yeah. And, oh man, just imagine if every time Christians put something of their religion on public land, the Satanists have something right next to it.
Hells yeah.
It would stop fast.
You really can't have Christianity without Satan.
Mm-mm.
I mean, that's the whole thing. So, you know, I've seen some religious writers saying that, you know, it's not a real religion. And I'm like, you know what? He's in your book.
Yeah.
Come on. Let them have their shit. Anyways, let's get on to the more crazy.
Yes. Fox News, of course, is the bastion of crazy. Megyn Kelly was covered a story about Santa. I'm going to play a clip from this.
Racist to have a white Santa, you know? And by the way, for all you kids watching at home, Santa just is white, but this person is just arguing that maybe we should also have a black Santa. But, you know, Santa is what he is, and just so you know, we're just debating this because someone wrote about it, kids. Okay, I wanted to get that straight. But just because it makes you feel uncomfortable doesn't mean it has to change. You know, I mean, Jesus was a white man too, but you know, it's like he was a historical figure. I mean, that's a verifiable fact, as is Santa. I just want the kids watching to know that.
Yes.
But my point is, how do you just revise it, you know, in the middle of the legacy of the story and change Santa?
Yeah.
Right. Because we've had people that were in Turkey that were born in Europe, like Saint Nicholas. Yeah. He was a white man born in Europe. Moved to Turkey sometime. Obviously the same for Jesus. I mean, his mom was obviously from Europe somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, the single standout white person.
Both were born in Asia. Both were died in Asia. Granted, okay, St. Nicholas, we have better evidence that he existed than Jesus. But people in that part of the world, whether you called them Greek or Jewish or whatever you want to call them, were not white. They were brown.
Yeah. There's definitely some extra melanin in their skin.
Mm-hmm. Now, I do want to, and it pains me to do this, do kind of need to back up Megyn Kelly a little bit here.
Oh, let's hear it.
Santa is definitely white. Because Santa Claus is not Saint Nicholas.
Sure.
This is a mythical character where they kind of merge Saint Nicholas and Odin. This mythical character has continued to change and evolve from dark skin to lighter and lighter skin. His clothing has changed. And by the time Coca-Cola and Hallmark got a hold of him, you got this jolly, fat, old white man. And yes, Santa has changed. He has, to quote the Mormons, as time has progressed, he's gotten whitesome and delightsome.
God damn it.
But the myth of Santa is as white as you want it to be. Now, if somebody, now this is where I differ from her. Saint Nicholas, the historical character that myth is based off of, was not white. Santa Claus is a very different and very mythical being. Some of the parts I cut from that segment included this article that was posted in Slate that brought up this whole discussion. A black woman who felt alienated by the white Santa was suggesting going with a more inclusive character like a penguin. And the biggest objection to Santa as a penguin is a penguin can't carry all those presents all around the world.
Like a fat man with a magic reindeer.
Yeah.
But
a magical penguin with magical reindeer could do just as much as a magical person with magical reindeer. honestly, I think it'd be cool to have multiple versions of the Santa myth.
I believe that penguins and reindeers are natural enemies.
They're from opposite ends of the globe. How could they even be enemies?
I was just making something up. But.
Yeah, it's a perfect blending of North and South, bringing the poles together, bringing white and black and together. The only group that it would alienate would be brown people.
Ooh, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, and I, of course, I also do have to bring up her thing about Jesus was historical and white.
I'm not even going to go so far as to say that Jesus is historical, period. That's just me.
There's no evidence to suggest that Jesus was a historical character. But just like how Santa Claus isn't based on any real person anymore, might be some loose basing, even if there was a historical Jesus. The mythical Jesus character of today is vastly different from anything that may possibly, even though probably didn't exist back in the day. And just like Santa has gotten whiter and whiter as time has gone on, Jesus has gotten whiter and whiter. And so if Megan wants Jesus to be white and Santa to be white, her Jesus and her Santa can be white. That's not going to change that the Ethiopian Jesus is black. And doesn't change the fact that some people might want a black Santa. She can have her myth. Let other people have theirs. All right, last story. So everyone's favorite televangelist slash crazy old coot, Pat Robertson, is finally coming around on LGBT rights.
What?
Well, sort of. He got asked by a viewer about, you know, what she should do to help her gay nephew, and he, you know, cited the American Psychiatric Association considering homosexuality a personality disorder until 1973, and, you know, the Supreme Court now views it as a protected right, and, you know, affirmed that homosexuality is a sin, but said, and I quote, "Now, I understand, and I've mentioned on this program that people need sex Now, I understand, and I've mentioned on this program that people need a sex change operation. In other words, it's a woman that's trapped in a man's body, a man trapped in a woman's body, and they really need some hormones and surgery to get that thing lined up. That's one thing. But this other, many, many other people are into this homosexual lifestyle because they've been abused as a child and so forth." So he's come around on transsexual rights. He's cool with that. But
you still can't be the gay.
Nope. Yeah.
Wow. What an odd stance to take.
Well, not unusual, I guess. Iran, for example, the state healthcare will fund sex change operations, but if you get caught having gay sex, you can get executed.
Just opens up a whole bunch of weird questions. If a woman gets a sex change and becomes a man, does that man now have all the rights of a man? You know, do they have to I'm guessing they don't have to wear a burqa anymore. Is there what? I mean, like, weird.
Yeah.
I mean, there's tons of odd little questions I would have.
Yeah. It's, yeah. In Iran, it's created a tough situation where gay people are often kind of forced into getting sex changes, even though they're not transgender, just as the only option to live the life that they want to live. They end up having to, well, not live the life that they want to live.
Yeah. Fucking weird.
Yeah, why not just let people be who they are, love who they love, and do what makes them happy?
It's good to see that Pat Robertson is at least as liberal as Iran.
Yeah.
Fuck. Crazy old fuck.
Yeah. Now, actually, on the front of transgender rights, I was looking at the American Atheist Convention website and actually came across a statement they have that to support the transgender community and genderqueer community, they have there's going to be restrooms designated as gender neutral at the convention site, as well as designated for men and women. And people will be free to use whichever one they feel most comfortable with.
Nice.
Yeah. That's pretty fucking awesome.
Well, fucking A.
Yeah, yeah.
And we hope to see you there. We hope to go, and we hope to see you there, too, in Salt Lake.
Coming up in April.
Hey.
Right before my birthday.
Right after mine.
Yeah, so hopefully we'll see you guys there, and you can buy Wesley a belated birthday drink and buy me a early 30th birthday drink.
You've got decisions. This versus That will help you make them. This versus That is an all-new six-hour series that uses science to investigate the world within arm's reach. For instance, what's the fastest way to navigate through highway traffic? Just stay in your lane and creep along, weave in and out of cars, taking advantage of every opening, or is it faster to take surface streets? This versus That will reveal the answer to that question and dozens more. This versus That is the web's number one choice for science enthusiasts, skeptics, and critical thinkers. Go to thisversusthatshow.com. Again, thisversusthatshow.com. This versus That. No bias, no bullshit, just science, fact, and funny.
Use offer code NOMADS when checking out to save 25% off your purchase at thisversusthatshow.com. That offer code, once again, is NOMADS.
Joining us now is Sean Faircloth. Sean is the author of Attack of the Theocrats, How the Religious Right Harms Us All and What We Can Do About It. Sean's extensive organizing, lobbying, and political experience includes spearheading over 30 laws, many pertaining to children and women's rights. During a decade in Maine's legislature, Faircloth earned a 100% voting record with the Maine Women's Lobby. Faircloth served on the Judiciary Committee, Appropriations Committee, and was elected Majority Whip. Faircloth creates specific strategies to organize for a better world based on reason and science as president of Global Secular Organizing and Strategy. Its projects include Secularity USA, co-founded with Alan Koslow. Faircloth was opening speaker for candidate Obama in Maine in 2008, served as opening speaker for Richard Dawkins on three tours, and Dawkins is making a personal appearance in support of Faircloth's new 501c3 as Faircloth branches off from being director of strategy and policy at the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science. After Faircloth's tour of New Zealand and Australia, including speaking at the Sydney Opera House, these countries organized first-ever policy-focused national coalitions. Global Secular Organizing and Strategy will organize similar efforts worldwide. Faircloth served as Executive Director for Secular Coalition of America, creating the 50-State Secular Coalition Plan, and he conceived the Maine Discovery Museum, leading the $4.5 million project from concept to completion. Sean, welcome to Atheist Nomads.
Hey, great to be with you.
Been a long time coming. Good to talk with you, man.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate being on the show, and I'm eager to kind of talk about the new project, Secularity USA, that we're working on, and happy to answer any questions you fellows have.
All right. So what is Secularity USA?
Secularity USA is the plan to return America to secular government by 2016. That is to counterbalance the religious right, to have a credible force that speaks out for church-state separation. And the plan is very detailed and specific. People can actually go to Global Secular Organizing and Strategy or just type in Secularity USA in Google and you'll find it. And you can look at the strategic plan. But it's not something we hope we might want to do sometime. This is a business plan that organizes people politically with a strategy that will succeed in 2016.
Excellent.
Yes. Okay. Very awesome.
What are some of the key steps you're seeing with that?
Sure. Well, let me kind of explain a little background about it. You mentioned in the introduction that I spoke in Australia, New Zealand. I had the great honor of speaking with A.C. Grayling at the Sydney Opera House, a couple thousand people at that event, and really went extremely well down there. But one of the things I learned from the organizers is some of your listeners may be aware, they had a huge Freethought conference in Australia that was bigger than anything that had been done in Europe or in North America. So they really did a fantastic job. Population of the whole country is only about 20 million people. So they really outdid themselves. And they were really excited. They had this huge, big event, and they were really pleased. And then they did it again. They held a second giant convention, also hugely successful, even more people. But the organizers whom I met with, they said, well, you know, it was great, but the second time just didn't feel quite the same, even though it was really fun, because we'd already done the kind of we're here, we're queer thing, you know. They've already done the, you know, here we are, and this is our community sort of approach. And the second time, they were wondering, well, what's next? What's the next big step? And the next big step, when I was meeting with them, I spoke in 14 cities, did 14 speaking engagements in New Zealand and Australia, was to form national coalitions that focus on public policy. And so they're really looking at church-state separation, because one of the ironic things, and some of your listeners may relate to this, is you could go to a convention of ours in Dublin, Kansas City, or Melbourne, Australia, and a lot of times the topics and oftentimes the speakers would be the same. And so they didn't really have anything that said, well, what are the problems for us in that case in Australia? And so part of the philosophy of Global Secular Organizing and Strategy is that we have this presence. As you mentioned in your introduction, I was in politics for 10 years. And, you know, when I got contacted, say, by the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, that would happen occasionally, but more often it would be the Civil Liberties Union of my state. You know, whether your state is Washington or Oregon or Florida or Georgia, those organizations kind of speak to the people locally. And we haven't really been doing that. And that's the concept here, is to kind of turn ourselves into a movement with a civic presence. But it goes beyond that. A key thing is really using political strategy and finding the weak point with the religious right in a very pragmatic way. And so we put together a very detailed action plan that we think is really going to fundamentally change American politics in 2016 in our favor. And this, by the way, would include people who are religious, but religious people who support the separation of church and state. So we'd create a new kind of strong political team between now and 2016.
How much is that team going to differ from the Secular Coalition of America and Americans United for Separation of Church and State?
Right. The Americans United for Separation of Church and State, excellent organization, have endorsed this project, Secularity USA, because it does something distinct. And you mentioned Secular Coalition for America. I was the executive director of Secular Coalition for America, and I put together the 50-state plan. You'll see they often tout the 50-state plan as sort of a flagship project of theirs, and I'm glad they do. However, that's more focused on lobbying. What I'm talking about here is 501c3. We are eligible for tax-deductible contributions. You can go to our website, Secularity USA or Global Secular, and see it. But this is really about a grassroots plan that falls under the umbrella of a 501c3. So we're not endorsing candidates. We're not lobbying. We're changing the political landscape. And let me give you a sense of how we're going to do this. I had a friend who was a doctor, a vascular surgeon in the state of Iowa. And he said, Sean, This guy's name is Alan Koslow. He sort of co-founded this with me. And he said, but this is before I knew about all that. He just said, hey, come check this out. Come see Iowa and the Iowa caucus process. And for those of you among your listeners who are aware, there didn't used to be an Iowa caucus process, really. It was Jimmy Carter back in the early 70s who had this pretty smart strategy where he bussed in people from Georgia. And while everybody else in the tradition of the day went to New Hampshire or other primaries, he snuck into Iowa, bussed in people to Iowa, had this discipline message about this totally unknown governor. And whether you think he's a good president or a bad president, it was a really smart plan. And it was sort of a sneak attack. So he won that Iowa caucus when nobody else was paying any attention. And that was the springboard that made him president of the United States. And sort of taking a page from that, what we're talking about is Iowa. Since his campaign, Iowa has more reporters per capita during that lead up to the caucus than anything you could see anywhere else. I mean, the reporters are just camped out there for months and months and months on end. I'm not talking about Iowa reporters. That's not really the focus here. The focus is on national and international reporters. I went to an event. I went to a Ron Paul event. This is in the 11-12 cycle. Went to a Ron Paul event, went to a Mitt Romney event, Michelle Bachmann, saw these kind of people. And I'd sit down and say, hi, how you doing? Where are you from? Thinking, okay, the person sitting next to me is going to say, I'm from Davenport, Iowa. I'm from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. No, I'm a reporter from Madrid. I'm a reporter from Tokyo, London, Los Angeles, New York. It's really amazing. And it only happens in this one place for this one period of time, about 8 months before the big caucus day. And our plan is to find this weak point with the religious right. I think the emperor wears no clothes with the religious right. They have much more perception of power than really is justified by their numbers. So Iowa is this low population state with a huge population of reporters. So we're going to organize you, that is your listeners, from all over the country. We have a business plan team set up. We've got an operations committee set up, volunteer committee set up. It's already good to go. We're going to spend 2014 organizing folks to get ready for 2015. So during 2014, we're going to have people who are leaders in every single state of the union, whether it's Idaho or Vermont. And they're going to say, okay, we're going to organize our people to head to Iowa, just like Jimmy Carter's team did back in the early 70s. We're also going to have Richard Dawkins, who's coming to Iowa in 2014, to build us a big volunteer base of people who are Iowans. But the key thing is we're having this team effort. So there's Iowa people, and then there's people from all over the country. So think of it as a reason rally, if you will, but a reason rally with a focused purpose that's going to change the history of this country, because we're going to be there day in and day out for 9 months. So picture one of your listeners. They don't need to go for 8-9 months. They need to go for 1 week, just a few days, and they're going to change American history. Why? Because we're going to have people spread out from all over the country coming during this entire period of time. They're going to wear Secularity USA t-shirts, and they are going to show up at every campaign event, Democratic event, Republican event, and we're going to offer a 10-point vision of a secular America, a very focused message that a lot of religious people can't support, that says get religion out of government. And everybody will have a single disciplined voice with which we're speaking, and we will hit the religious right by surprise where they're not expecting it and get huge national media attention.
Hmm. Sounds like an excellent way to get free publicity.
Yeah.
To get your face and your message out there everywhere all at once.
There's really nothing else like it. I mean, because if you look at, say, reporters in the big electoral vote states, you know, Texas, California, your chance of getting next to a Hillary Clinton or a Governor Christie, it's de minimis. You know, it's just they're huge crowds, very difficult. But in the early Iowa process, Dr. Koslow, the guy I mentioned, he would do this for healthcare, and a lot of times he'd do it by himself, and he sort of made it his avocation, his hobby. So he would show up at Republican events, Democratic events. He'd ask the same exact question, the same exact way, you know, disciplined. And he'd ask this question, though, next to Joe Biden and in front of CNN reporters. So he'd get his message out nationally on a particular issue. Now, picture you, me, and a bunch of volunteers from around the country. We're getting our message out. And then when they attack us, as they will, they'll say, look at those dirty atheists, and we will have hundreds upon hundreds over the course of 9 months. So, yes, indeed, there will be us there. But we'll also have a rabbi from Iowa and a minister from Iowa who's on our team say, yep, and we're here too, and we agree, and we're all on the same page. We want religious bias out of government. And that will be something the media has never seen before. So a big, huge media story, and one that will sort of show that the religious right emperor wears no clothes.
It sounds amazing. I mean, yeah. I don't see why every religious person doesn't want this themselves, because it levels the playing field for everybody.
And to be fair, there's a lot of religious people who already do that and activate yeah. for it. There's something called the Interfaith Alliance, and they're like liberal. I don't mean liberal like necessarily party liberal, but liberal in terms of religion, and they generally support the separation of church and state. So we're going to build a team with them. Like a lot of times we've kind of stayed in our ghetto, and we need to get beyond that. And so in this campaign, it's fine with me if you have a conversation at the bar, because this is going to be one big party. We're going to be bussing people in with guitars and, you know, people taking their party bus to Iowa. We're going to have a good time of this. It's not going to be some earnest thing. People are going to whoop it up in Iowa. So if you become friendly with some minister and you want to say at the bar, you know, in your conversation, well, I happen to think you're incorrect about your belief in God, but you do it on that friendly term, that's totally fine. But once we get in front of the TV cameras, we, the minister, the rabbi, and us are all preaching from the same hymnal, if you will, and it's about keeping religion out of government. And we use from chapter 3 of my book, the 10-point vision, which is very focused on human harm. That is, and often religious people are harmed by religious bias in government. So we're all on the same team, and we're keeping it to that focus. And that'll be very difficult to overcome, because the 10-point vision of a secular America is all about how children, women, gay people in the military, many other categories, both religious and non-religious, are harmed by religious bias. And it makes it difficult for the other side, because we're going to not engage in the sort of more abstract debates. We're just going to say, we're here for the children. We're here for the kids who are harmed by this. And it's sort of hard to dismiss children who are harmed in, say, for example, faith healing homes and things like that. So we're going to frame ourselves, and I mean the free thought community, as taking the moral high ground and welcoming others to join us.
Sean, you've been kind of going over the short-term goals. Can you go over the long-term goals as well?
Yes. So once we get our springboard, so think of, let me go back short-term a bit and then I'll get to long-term. So 2014 is all about the organizing. So Idaho, that we have a state leader in Idaho, they organize people. Because let's face it, Idaho's kind of like the opposite of, I don't know, California or Hawaii, where they are always Democratic, Idaho's always Republican. And in some ways, people in both are kind of left out of the process. But you bring those people to Iowa, and they can have a huge impact. You know, it really gives a chance for people from states that are sort of out of it in presidential elections to say, we're in it, because we're going to affect this Iowa process in a big way. Okay, so then we get in 2015, after we've organized throughout all of 2014, I need your listeners to volunteer right now and go to Secularity USA and fill out our volunteer form. But then we organize through 2014, we do this big media event, and I'm talking about an 8-month media event through 2015. So then we have a bunch of trained people who are organizers. And you'll see our plan is very detailed. People kind of learn how to be political organizers, which our movement has not done, nowhere near as well as the religious right has done, okay? Then they bring their message back home. So someone from California says, okay, I'm going to go back, and now I've got the T-shirt, I've got the message, I've got the organizing cred, I know how to roll. I'm going to get out, and I'm going to do this with our organization in California and get involved in the congressional race, the state senate race, always with the 10-point vision, discipline message, always aligning with those religious groups who are willing to stand for church-state separation. Then even more long-term than that, after we've had what I call a culture change within atheism and free thought, where we've sort of turned ourselves from sort of, we tend toward the debating society mode to the political organizing mode, then we say, okay, we're going to have our free thought conventions. And just like I talked about in Australia and New Zealand and what we did down there, same thing in California, Idaho, Georgia. There's a free thought convention for Idaho. Maybe it's every 2 years. But this convention, certainly you try to get your big national speaker. Certainly you try to get your Sam Harris or whatever you want to get. Of course, you're going to want to do that. But then you're also going to have someone from University of Idaho or a local politician who's willing to talk about church-state separation issues. So you have that kind of local focus and jurisdictional focus, I call it. So then people, like I said, I experienced when I was in politics. So just like I got contacted by the Maine Civil Liberties Union, you get contacted by the Idaho Free Thought Convention, and they invite you to speak. They invite you to their cocktail reception. They tell you their issues, and they start talking about stuff in an informed way. So it's a culture change for us long term. And of course, the huge thing is we get a massive media burst in 2015 and going into 2016 that brings in new people to our movement, brings in new activists to our movement.
Yeah. And thinking about how that would work in Idaho, since that's actually where I live, there are a few people in the state legislature that would be willing to, well, at least potentially willing to show their faces at events like that.
I don't know if she's still there. I know there was a documentary. I don't want to get too off on Idaho here, but there was a documentary on PBS a few years back about the Idaho legislature. And when I was in politics, there was a state legislator from Idaho. She was an open lesbian, really cool lady. Again, it sort of illustrates, because I bet a lot of your listeners might think Idaho, most right-wing place on earth, and there's a good argument that it is. but nonetheless, just because that's true, it doesn't mean there's not the opportunity in certain places and with certain portions of the community where you can get our message out. And I think that we are on the cusp, and that this Secularity USA that I hope your folks will Google and volunteer for, that the Secularity USA plan gives us that foothold. It first gives us the big foothold nationally, because it's this sneak attack in Iowa. They're not going to see us. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition, and nobody expects a bunch of really politically organized atheists and humanists and free thinkers to show up in Iowa. And they're going to dismiss us. They're going to ignore us. And then they're going to see us week after week after week, and they go, whoa, this thing's got some legs. And the national reporters get to us. So then when you get back home to Idaho, mm-hmm. do I expect that the culture, you know, the sort of right-wing dominance in Idaho's going to change tomorrow? No, of course not. But you start to get a foothold, and you start to get people looking at state issues, and you start to, like you talk about, get certain elected officials who are willing to speak, and academics who know about the laws in that state who are willing to speak. Yeah. And the same thing is happening in every single other state of the union as a result of this Secularity USA process. So that's the long game and a bit of the short game as well.
And that woman you brought up, and her name is escaping me, but
Nicole Fleur.
Yes.
Very cool.
She ran for U.S. Senate in, I believe it was 2012.
Yeah.
And if there's one particular state district in Boise, Boise's north end is the most liberal part of town.
Right.
It had the lowest voter turnout in the state. And if they'd had, I believe it was 40% turnout, she would have won that Senate seat.
Oh, right. Man. Yeah, I mean,
one district.
she's a very good lady. Yeah, Nicole Lefevre, and she and I went to this conference of kind of, I guess you'd call it, lefty legislators in, well, there was a few of sort of like a training program for us. Actually, Kyrsten Sinema, who's now the member of the U.S. House from Arizona, that sort of similar type of person, really cool. And every state has a pocket. Every state has a place where our team can already win. So people should not be as discouraged as they sometimes are. And then furthermore, what I think we need to do is, it's just like if you were African American in the 30s and 40s, or not just like, but I mean, like, you understand if you're African American in the 30s and 40s, or if you're gay in the 70s, you're not going to get what you want immediately. Unfortunately, that's the reality of the situation. But what this plan does is first gives us a big springboard of publicity in 2015 and 2016 to attract new people, and also attract a new type of person. That is, get people who are kind of the organizers, the software developers, the business people who say, you know, maybe I already don't believe in God. I've already kind of settled that much. So I don't necessarily feel that, you know, I'll go to a meeting for that. But if you say we're going to change the nature of American society, they're in for a meeting. for that. They're willing to participate. And that's where I think this can be really, really helpful. And then over time, and certainly Idaho's probably the steepest mountain to climb of any state you could pick, but we'll go with that example, is you work that state and you say, all right, where are our angles? And you meet the right people. And maybe there's someone, for instance, a lot of times there's sort of people who you might be perceiving as far on the right, like sort of the hardcore libertarians, who would also be on our side on this issue. So you never know what bedfellows you can make, you know? So I think there's a huge culture change that can be achieved by Secularity USA. But step number one, I can't emphasize this enough, is 2015 does not work unless 2014 works. So your listeners who say, I want to do something to change America, this is their chance.
Fucking yeah. A.
For sure. Yeah, if you don't get the volunteers together and the money together.
2014 is the year for that. So yeah. We have a preliminary website now. We're going to have a new website unveiled by the new year. We're going to have, right now we have the people go to Secularity USA. You can read our business plan and we're pretty proud of it. This is a team of people. I have a guy who's chair of our operations committee who's with Booz Allen. And for your listeners who don't know, Booz Allen's, sort of a business strategy firm. So, he's the head of our operations committee. We have two people in our troika of the operations committee, Jennifer and David, who are just working their guts out hours after hours on this project. We have a head of a volunteer committee who's a really sort of high-powered IT guy. We have marketing people. We have Faisal Saeed Al-Muhtar that some of you may know, who's sort of our public relations director. He moved here, some of your listeners may know, from Iraq not too long ago, and he runs the Global Secular Humanist Movement Facebook page where you can read a lot about our projects. And so we've got this really fantastic crack team of people. And it's kind of bringing this kind of new excitement and energy to the movement. But you're right. The key thing is getting leaders in every state in 2014. We do that part, that spade work now, and then 2015 will be a big success.
Now, is there any fear that with trying to pull volunteers from all over that it will weaken the existing free thought communities?
Well, I think it will actually grow all of the free thought groups. And let me tell you why. I spoke impromptu the other day at an event in the Bay Area in California. And there was a diverse group that showed up. And one actually, I mean, this isn't me saying this. Some of the people who were there said that, in fact, we ended up with four times as many because people came to hear about this project than they originally projected for the gathering. But even more important than that is after people heard the presentation, they said, this is what I've been looking for. I'm already not religious. I'm already sort of convinced on that. So now I've been kind of wondering when I attend these meetings, what's there really to do? And I think what you're going to get is a whole new set of people. You'll keep the people you have and engage them in something exciting to do. But I think there's a whole new set of people who are kind of holding back because they didn't see the point of it, or it wasn't their cup of tea to go to some meeting and say, well, here's my reasons why I don't believe in God, or here's my reasons why I think evolution is true, because they already believe those things. So then that kind of personality type says, this I'm in for. And so it helps whatever kind of group, whether you're on the strident atheist end of the spectrum or the, whatever you want to call it, the accommodationist end of the spectrum, it's all good by me that the non-religious community says, we're going to build an activist team and everybody's included in that. And I think a lot of people, this is what they've been crying for. They want something that says, how do I affect the larger society? And so that's what I think this will do to grow the entire movement. In fact, I think that's a key part of the strategy. In addition to sort of changing the American political landscape, which is sort of the outward strategy, the inward strategy is to kind of have growth and culture change within the free thought movement.
I can't think of a single atheist that would like to be run by a religiously influenced government. So accommodationist or not, I could see this being spread across everybody and
mm-hmm.
every group.
Exactly. You're making a really good point here because Let's face it, you know, the hard reality is within our movement, we can't agree to what we call ourselves, right? I mean, how many times have you seen that debate, right, about the brights or humanist or whatever term? You know, all that, it seems like, and I've been watching this now for 4 years myself, and I'm sort of thinking, well, that debate, probably they'll be planting me in the ground and they'll still be having that debate. And that's fine. That's just how it is. And maybe people just want to identify with the term that's most comfortable for them, and that's cool. But here is something that we do all agree on. It pretty much, if you take your most, I don't know, religion-friendly humanist or your most religion-hostile atheist, they all agree on church-state separation. And so it's really a commonality for all of us. That's really important. And that's a key thing is we're taking this to another level of sophistication. So this 10-point vision of a secular America that I talk about in my book and in the chapter 3 of my book, I go through example after example after example, and intentionally, they're not symbolic issues. So, I'm a lawyer, and if I were a judge and you put me on the stand, you know, in the judge's bench and you said, what about that cross on public land in California, I'd be the first person to say, nope, that's going off. We're removing that from public land or the Ten Commandments and all that kind of stuff. But that's not what this is about, because that's me thinking like a lawyer, which is, that's important, and I stand by that principle. But when you're thinking like a politician, we got to figure how we're going to appeal to the broader community. So chapter 3 and the focus of our message is human impact. How are people harmed? People harmed by religious bias. And chapter 3 just gives you example after example after example after example where you can go to your neighbor and say, and I'm talking about a religious neighbor, you know, say they're a Methodist or United Church of Christ, whatever. You know, they're probably, you know, pretty reasonable people. And you say, well, do you know about this law that involves where a lot of child cares in many states are exempted from health and safety laws? Isn't that pretty awful? And you can give an example of, in fact, where a child died in one of these situations. That's the kind of thing where your neighbor, your soccer mom, your Joe Sixpack, even if they go, yeah, I'm in principle religious, they might say, I agree with you that that's wrong. That's a problem. And that's what we want to do, is kind of have this consistent theme that we follow through with. When we get not only to Iowa, but when we return from that process to all our respective states.
Yeah. Yeah, we have definitely have that issue right where I'm at. And that's something that's the faith healing cults in particular keeps coming up in the media. And hopefully, you know, it's gaining ground.
Well, the sad part of it is, and as an attorney, and I used to be an assistant attorney general who did child protection cases, and my mother was a child protection investigator, so this is sort of a personal issue for me in the sense of my career, and even my mother's career was involved in this, is most people don't know, and I document really ugly examples of this in my book, that state laws, in fact, the majority of states, they don't make it legal, but they make it easier based on what's called the medical neglect law for so-called faith healing parents to medically neglect their children. I mean, it's one thing if the parents secretly do it. That's horrible and that's bad. But it's even worse if the government somehow lends an imprimatur to that. And unfortunately, the ministers of these, you know, I consider them crackpot congregations, but the ministers of these congregations can honestly stand up in front of their congregation and say, well, the state gives us more leeway for this. You know, I don't know how they'd phrase it, and they might be even, you know, they might move into dishonesty about how they represent it, but they can even honestly say that. And that's an outrage. That's terrible that that can happen. And that's the emphasis of the 10-point vision, is it goes beyond what individually people might do that's wrong to the government is involved in allowing for this. And that's something that's really got to change.
And when you have enough issues that you bring up, eventually one of those will resonate with just about everyone out there.
Well, that's another excellent point. Why the 10-point vision of a secular America is a central strategy to Secularity USA is exactly what you just said. The most important point for me about Secularity USA, and I do hope folks will go to the Secularity USA website, is that, you know, in my 10 years in politics, I would see the religious right had political power, even in places like the Northeast, you know, where it's not like Mississippi or something. They still have traction. They still have noteworthy power in every state of the union. And we don't. And I think that our viewpoint, I don't think I know, our viewpoint, certainly with regard to church-state separation, so you include the liberal religious who agree with us, our viewpoint is the majority viewpoint. And frankly, I think we need to condemn ourselves a little bit and say, you know, we've been sitting on our hands a little bit too much. And that this is going to take the people who say, we care enough to make major societal change. And the thing about Secularity USA is that it's going to be fun. It's going to be kind of a celebration of us and of what we're doing. And that we're spearheading and leading this project. And, you know, now there's this movement for, you know, they call it Sunday Assembly, the whether you like it or don't like it, but the sort of atheist church people call it. That's fine with me. That's good with me. But then I heard something about, you know, they don't want to have political. Well, I commend them for their efforts. But for me, when you remember the great things that some churches did do, like some liberal churches did stuff for civil rights back in the 60s and black churches did stuff for civil rights back in the 60s, we don't remember about what the preacher preached that day. What we remember is that they organized to change the world and make it better, something they could be proud of and tell their grandkids about. That's what Secularity USA is. I think that if people say, I'm going to volunteer, as you can, at Secularity USA right now, and you get in on the organizing in 2014, that is something you can tell your grandkids and say, you know, I was involved in something that really mattered and changed America for the better. And I think if we do that and commit ourselves to it, it's really going to grow this movement.
God damn. Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm happy to answer any questions you guys have. You said you want to ask me questions about myself or, yeah.
All right. Well, this is an adult-themed podcast, I'll be honest.
Yeah, I don't think we've gotten you to cuss yet.
Oh, right. Well, you know, one thing I would say, when you say adult-themed, is go to chapter 4 of my book, which talks about sex. And I think our viewpoint is the moral viewpoint. I said when I was in the legislature, the religious right would come testify. And when they testified, they used the word moral. And you could definitely tell that what they meant by moral was that I was immoral because I was for equality for gay people and pro-choice and that sort of thing. And I said, no, you're word thieves. You're stealing the word moral. That's not what moral means. Moral has to do with helping people who are left out, helping people who are underprivileged. That's what moral means. And you lecturing me about my naughty bits or other people about their naughty bits, that's not moral at all. And it really violates small town values, real small town values that I would, you know, speak of from back in Maine would be mind your own business. That's real small town values.
Gotcha. Sure. The religious right really hijacked the world moral.
They did. They stole it. And we need to take it back and use it for its proper purpose. And so when you talk about an adult theme, I think, let's face it, a lot of religious right attitudes and viewpoints, and I document this extensively, both in the statutory end in Chapter 3 and then in sort of a societal analysis in Chapter 4 of my book, they have a real, I'd say, twisted problem with sex. They don't take a scientific view of it, which I think is a much more moral view of human sexuality. And that if you treat it as, you know, a part of life, to be considered positively, to make sure to be responsible and, you know, not be getting or giving diseases or getting pregnant when it's not planned. But that overall, sex is something to be celebrated and thought of in a very positive way. And their way of thinking of it, I think, is deeply harmful to our fellow citizens. And I document a lot of examples of that in our book. And unfortunately, they have been successful because of their organizing, which has been pretty effective. They've been successful in insinuating their sexual twisted attitudes into American law. And it's up to us to show an equal level of passion for organizing to reverse that trend.
I think I would be remiss for our female listeners and, well, for all of our listeners, really, if I didn't ask you, A, what's your shoe size? And B, you got a favorite position since we're bringing up sex all this time?
Shoe size. Well, see, I don't believe in that appendage issue. I got damn small feet, so you're really wrecking, I think, my reputation. But I'd say, I don't know. My favorite position, I don't know. Cuddling. Yeah, actually, I do sort of like that.
Pre or post coital?
Get on you, man. Get on you.
Hey, my mom could listen to this podcast. No.
I've seen you tell your mom to ignore certain posts on your Facebook wall. So,
yes,
you
know, that's true. Yeah, I used the F word once and I didn't want my mom. My mom comes from, she's a very great lady. And she actually comes from a fundamentalist background, but she's never pushed that or she doesn't go there. And she doesn't really go to church anymore anyway. But she's the type of mom where, you know, I've never cursed in front of her.
Mm. Nice. And what's this F word you speak of?
My F word that I want to see become part of general society so that day to day everybody uses it is free thought.
Oh, nicely done, sir.
Well played. Well played.
Well, listen, I hope you guys will please yourselves as hosts, maybe return to this issue of Secularity USA and ask your listeners to consider it, because I don't mean to sound too highfalutin about it, but just because of the nature of the calendar, because that's when 2016 elections come and that's when the Iowa caucus process is in 2015, is that we have this fantastic opportunity, but it's time limited. So we really need people among your listeners to say, you know what? I'm a software developer. I can help them with their website and their internet strategy. I'm a marketer. I can volunteer and help. I know how to do phone banks. I can help. I'm just a plain bossy person, and I'm willing to be a state leader and get other people to do stuff. That you name your skill or your inclination, you can volunteer for this project and make a big difference.
By all means, I want to go. I would love to get bussed out there and earn
also,
my
the other key thing is, I swear to you, in this job, I travel a lot, speak in a lot of different places. I stand by this assertion. Maybe the best bar I've ever been to in America is the High Life Bar in Des Moines, Iowa. So after we change American society, go to the High Life Bar in Des Moines, hang out. They also have a fantastic zombie burger. So this is going to be changing America one great party at a time.
Awesome. And there's no way to gather atheists quite like alcohol.
As long as they're working hard during the daytime, they got to get up the next morning. I say they party at night.
Hell yeah. All right, Sean, it's been a real pleasure having you on.
Hey, great having you. Really appreciate it.
Definitely. Yes. Thanks a bunch, man.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Atheist Nomads. You can find us online at www.atheistnomads.com. Contact us at contact@atheistnomads.com or leave us a voicemail message at 541-203-0666. You can also like us on Facebook or leave us a review on iTunes, Zoom, or wherever else you find the podcast. Until next time, this has been the Atheist Nomads. Besides, if it's sex toys, I'll just assume it's Wesley.
This is true. This is so true. Fuck a duck. All right, sure, fine.
I really hope that's not the sex toy you just bought.
What?
A duck.
Was it? No ducks.
And now I need to let the dog out. I'll be right back.
Okay.
He was quietly grunting right by the door.
Dog has a bell, right?
Has what?
The dog has a bell on its collar?
No bell. He's just got enough stuff on it that it does cling around so you can hear it when he's walking around.
Okay, yeah, because I heard the bell like a couple minutes ago.
Yeah, it's not clink. Actually a bell. It's just a couple tags. Really, it's clinky. Just the tag.
Hmm.
It clings, which can be nice. It can also be annoying. On the hardwood floor, his claws do also click.
Hmm.
But he has sounds a... Like, oh, go ahead.
Sounds like they need trimming.
Yeah, they probably do. He also has developed a really nice habit for when he needs to go outside to start with quiet little type sounds.
Yeah.
Little half barks. And nice. If you don't respond within about 90 seconds, then he'll start real barks.
Oh, well, cool.
Yeah, it works quite nice.
Fairly polite.
Uh-huh.
One of us has to piss here.
Okay.
No. I'm just saying the dog.
Oh, yes. Now, often that works out in the morning to when I need to piss, so.
Yeah.
So I can sleep till 11 or 11:30.
Yeah, me too.
Noon. Yeah.
I'm actually just lounging out on my couch in my sleeping bag. It was like, fuck it.
Let me explain. By example.
Let's pause. We lost Wesley.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Wesley, are you back? You're really breaking up.
Oh, yeah. That didn't sound too good.
That was really choppy.
Okay. I'm back. Happy birthday, Jesus!